Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will and Emery, and Rich Lenkov. From Downey and Lenkov, I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court is back in Washington after a late summer recess. It appears the justices actually kind of have a little bit of a lighter calendar in the coming weeks. Here to give us our annual preview on what we can expect is Allison LaCroix, a Robert Newton Reed Professor of Law, Associate Member of the Department of History at the University of Chicago. Professor, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Our 10th annual Supreme Court preview. We're thrilled to have you. Right here in our hometown of Chicago. So we're just going to go through some of these cases and ask you to explain what they're about and why we should be paying attention to them, a couple of which were just argued this week. So the first one is this Garland versus Vandersaw case dealing with ghost guns, something we know a lot about here in Illinois. What's that one all about, Professor?
Well, it's an interesting case, and it has connections to a couple of things the court was doing when we last checked in with them last term. So first, it's a challenge to federal agency action and federal rulemaking. So that fits in with some of the cases we saw about Chevron and the other big kind of landmark cases at the end of last term. And then this one's also about firearms. So it connects to gun rights and some other cases that we saw last term as well, especially the bump stocks case. So this one is about regulation about basically kits to make guns, ghost guns, firearms without serial numbers. You can make them from a kit. And an agency, the ATF, issued a rule regulating these guns. We also have an act of Congress that regulation came under. The act of Congress is a little older. It's from 1968. And so the question is both, are these gun kits covered by the rule? Is the rule within the agency's authority under the statute? So again, we get the kind of question about firearms regulation, which ties into a bunch of other cases that we've seen lately, and also this broader question about the status of administrative agencies and regulation more generally.
So, Professor, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to talk a little bit about the oral argument on Tuesday, which I thought was tremendously interesting and featured portions that felt a lot like a law school hypothetical, with the justices asking the Solicitor General and the other advocates, is a kit a gun, essentially, right? And this sort of, is this one thing like another thing? So at one point, I think the claim was made, is a kit a gun for purposes of this rule when all it lacks is a single undrilled hole, right? Or the Solicitor General said she was able to put it together, one of these together in 15 minutes. Therefore, is it close enough to being the kind of firearm or weapon that's covered under the statute? And the justices, including some of the conservative justices, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Barrett, seemed a bit skeptical of the challengers' arguments. They seemed it's always a risk of tea leaf reading, of course, but they seemed like they felt like there were reasons that this type of item would be covered under the rule and that the rule was therefore permitted under the statute.
So, Professor, the court also just heard arguments in a case of Glossop versus Oklahoma. Richard Glossop is a death row inmate in Oklahoma who has challenged his conviction and requested a new trial in connection with the 1997 killing of the owner of the motel at which Glossop worked. Can you tell us more about this case?
Yeah, this is a really fascinating case with a lot of complicated issues and sort of technical issues, and then also not technical, fundamental kind of justice questions, obviously, when we're talking about the death penalty. It's unusual and atypical in death penalty challenges because here the state of Oklahoma, represented by the attorney general of the state, is now seeking to overturn Mr. Glossop's conviction. He is also seeking to appeal at least the death penalty sentence, if not the conviction. So then you have this interesting question of, well, who's on the other side if the state has said, we don't think this execution should go forward? And who's on the other side are essentially the state courts of Oklahoma, who now appear before the Supreme Court with a lawyer. So that's a kind of interesting setup. And their argument is, look, this is a state law matter. He's exhausted all his avenues of appeal. We can't reconsider the sentence. It's just too late. He's had all the opportunities he could have. This is close to 30 years on. And the technical issue is actually also very profound and important, because it's about what we could think of as federalism questions. Can the Supreme Court even hear this case? Because there's an argument to be made, and the advocates raise this at oral argument, that the state, this is just entirely a state law issue. And so there isn't even a jurisdictional basis for the Supreme Court to get involved, separate from the question of the kind of death penalty issues. And so then the justices had this very interesting back and forth with multiple attorneys, multiple former solicitors general of the United States representing different parties, about what do we do when one part of the state says, you know, we don't need to go forward with this execution. But the state courts say, look, this is our job and we've reached a final decision here. So it's, you know, obviously we are talking literally about life and death issues, and also these deep questions about the federal government and its relationship to states. And, you know, that ties into a lot of other debates we've been seeing lately about states and their powers. So I think this case has a lot of really fascinating arms to it.
I listened to some of that case and I found it interesting, somewhat depressing, that Clarence Thomas seemed more concerned about the rights of the prosecutors and their names, you know, being insulted, rather than the due process issues that were involved. But let's talk about U.S. versus Scarametti. This is a Tennessee ban on certain sex transition treatments for minors experiencing gender dysphoria.
Yeah, so this is a case out of Tennessee. There was also a Kentucky statute and a few other states as well. So here, Tennessee, in this particular state law, prohibited all medical treatments about gender-affirming care, specifically puberty blockers, hormone therapy for transgender adolescents. Clearly, this is a major issue in the kind of political and social debates of the moment, part of a larger trend of state restrictions on gender-affirming medical care. And it's important to note that those kinds of state law bans have been opposed by major medical groups, the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and lots of others. And then what's also interesting here is a lot of deep questions about parental rights that cut against some of how we hear parental rights being talked about in other domains lately. So I think often when we hear about parental rights these days, it's parents in the school context, right, saying, I don't want my children to read those books. I don't want the teachers to teach them about certain hot button issues, controversial topics, especially about, say, race or the United States history with Jim Crow and slavery. Here, parental rights arguably are on the other side of the argument, because the Tennessee law would ban, by banning this care, it would take away parents' rights to seek that kind of care for their children. This was something that the circuit court below talked a bit about. But I think it will be notable to see how the parental rights kind of arguments here shake out. Another thing that's interesting in this case is the Tennessee law has a provision that says basically private enforcement. So penalties, but also individual people can go around, you know, if they so choose, suing doctors and other healthcare providers who violate the law. That's something we've seen in the abortion context as well. These state laws that specifically say private parties can bring suit to enforce. And I think that gives rise to a whole host of concerns, including how do you challenge the law? Because it's complicated to challenge a law that gives private parties these rights to sue. And also, you know, just what that does to kind of society in general, this kind of reporting on each other element of the way the law is actually constructed.
So, Professor, the last case we're going to take a look at is a challenge that the court has agreed to hear, a challenge to a Texas online age verification law, whereby websites with pornography are required to use age verification technology and to have health warnings on their pages. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about this case?
Yes. So this is coming out of Texas, coming up to the Supreme Court from the Fifth Circuit, but starting out in Texas with Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, bringing suit against two web companies on the basis of an alleged violation of state law. So Texas state law that says, listen, websites, especially ones that have adult content, pornographic content, other forms of content, have to have reasonable age verification measures. And then, of course, there's a question about what's reasonable. And so the allegation that the state attorney general is making here is that these websites allow minors to access obscene materials, pornographic materials, without any kind of screening or age verification. And so they're not doing what they're supposed to do under state law. Meanwhile, the state law is being opposed by a number of free speech and other groups who basically say, listen, this is a law that applies. It doesn't only apply to minors. It kind of can't. The way it works is that people have to register and verify their age and so forth. So the opposition is arguing not so much about the minors, but more about the effect this has on adults who might be accessing the material, and also making the argument that this is a very significant burden on those adults' First Amendment free speech rights, because they will have to perhaps identify themselves and fill out other kind of online forms. So it's another one of these cases where we have a state being very, one could say aggressive, one could say entrepreneurial, kind of setting out pretty firm state law on very high profile issues of political and cultural salience. And then there being a lot of knock-on effects from what the state's trying to do, which brings other parties into the case, whether it's, again, these free speech groups, or in the Tennessee case that we just talked about, the Biden administration has intervened. So these aren't just local state law issues. They obviously have much farther reaching consequences.
And Professor LaCroix is also author LaCroix. You have a book out called The Interbellum Constitution, Union, Commerce, and Slavery in the Age of Federalism. Is it behind you right now? You've got a lot of books behind you.
Yeah, it's definitely behind me.
It's somewhere back there.
All around me. Gotcha.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. The East Coast dock worker strike could have been the October surprise politicians were waiting for and the holiday surprise we were all dreading. But for now, the strike's been averted. We've got till January to see if a new contract can be reached. William Bruscher is an assistant professor on labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers in beautiful New Brunswick, New Jersey. He's been tracking this story for us. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Professor, as Ryan mentioned, the International Longshoremen's Association, which is the union representing 45,000 dock workers, went on strike last week to dispute their wages as well as the use of automation in their jobs. And after rejecting an offer of almost a 50% wage increase over a six-year period, the union reached a deal to suspend the strike until January 15. Can you tell us more about the reasons for this strike and the decision to suspend it?
Well, let's first start with wages. When the last agreement was negotiated prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, it had what for the time, good, you know, steady wage increases. But with the pandemic, with record inflation in recent years, the value of the wage went down. Of course, meanwhile, longshore workers were they faced essentially a port shutdown when lockdown started, but then when consumer demand really started to rise and there were all these problems in the supply chain, they wound up having to work, you know, extraordinary hours around the clock. And really that created a lot of discontent among the members that their work should be paid better and that they had earned all these profits at the expense of their working lives. So that was it. And then the other thing, and this is interesting about longshore labor relations in the U.S., is that West Coast dock workers are represented by a different union that had split from the ILA in the late 1930s. The union there, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, has a different structure and different culture and history. But since really since the late 50s, 1960s and on, the two unions have been very supportive of one another. And because their contracts don't line up, when one coast negotiates a new agreement, the other coast is in a position, you know, to use that as a benchmark and potentially improve on it. And so what had happened last year in a contract retroactive to 2022, the ILWU on the West Coast negotiated wage increases that are much higher than on the East Coast. And so that was part of it. The ILA could demand, you know, higher wages, but also because their agreement was then going to go to 2030, and because of all the profits in the industry and because of the work that the members have been doing in recent years, they were in a really good position to demand higher wages and hold out for them. So that's the wage component of it. The other one, of course, is automation. And both longshore unions have traditionally negotiated with their respective maritime employer associations over the introduction of new technologies on the docks. Now, in the ILA on the Eastern Gulf Coast, what that has entailed are container royalty funds where the union gets money based on the amount of tons of cargo that they're handling through shipping containers. And that's been used for wage supplements. That's been used for health and pension benefits. And so that's one way in which they've done it. They have also had in place for several contracts, a new technology committee where both U.S. Maritime Alliance and ILA leaders have to sit down and negotiate over new technologies that come in. Essentially, the union has to agree to it. And so that's already something the union was very strong on. And of course, they could insist on maintaining that contract language, maintaining the guarantee that even as new technologies are introduced to the docks, that ILA members get those jobs and they don't become non-union jobs or unions or other unions will do those jobs. So that was the main sticking point. But given the time we're at now, the members are clearly were ready to strike. Harold Daggett has proven himself to be a very fiery leader, a militant leader, and one I think has earned the real respect and admiration of other the locals in the ILA up and down the coast, and also especially among the rank and file. And so it was a very good time for them. And also the political dimension is very important because President Biden, any U.S. president, has the right to seek an injunction, a cooling off period under the Taft-Hartley Act when a strike is of national importance or even international importance. So things involving interstate trade, global trade, of course, with the maritime industry. And Biden very clearly said that he wasn't going to do it. I think he meant that. And then when the pressure was on to reach an agreement, instead of going to the union, the administration then put the pressure on the Maritime Alliance to come back with a much better wage offer, over 60% over the lifetime of the contract. Some of that front-loaded, a lot of it front-loaded into the first year of the contract. And then I think it also signals that the Maritime Alliance and the union are really not that far apart on the outstanding issues. And I would be very surprised if the strike resumes in January.
So, Professor, you mentioned the Taft-Hartley Act, which I very erroneously thought was attributed to our very portly former president, William Howard Taft, known as the largest of all presidents at a whopping 315 pounds. Sure. Unfortunately, it doesn't refer to him because I've been waiting for 10 years to discuss William Howard Taft on this program. But yeah, it refers to Senator Taft. So give us a little more detail about what that is. To your point, Biden was maybe pressured to invoke it. He didn't do that. But it has been invoked 37 times since it was put into passed into law in 1947, including by George W. Bush in 2002. So under what circumstances do you think presidents should be invoking this, and when have they and why?
All right. So one quick thing. Robert A. Taft was the son of William Howard Taft, and was really huge in U.S. politics, Ohio politics, but also U.S. politics more generally. So there is a direct connection there.
Huge, not in terms of his weight.
Well, I don't remember.
Was Robert Taft a heavier size. A heavier gentleman?
I forget it was his father or Warren G. Harding, and there's the story about the bathtub, but anyway, in the White House. But Robert Taft, Fred Hartley from New Jersey, where I work, the Republican congressman, ushered in the Taft-Hartley Act, also known as the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947. And this was a sweeping act that put real changes and actually restrictions on union rights under the National Labor Relations Act. It essentially amended that. It had a bunch of provisions. So it outlawed what's called the union shop it's the closed shop where being a union member was a precondition for employment. Instead, unions in non-right to work states are allowed to, sign negotiate a contract that makes somebody a member on their 30th day of employment. It also enabled right to work laws which exist in over half the states in the U.S. that forbid union membership clauses in them. So there can be contracts, but the union can't enforce membership on any of the workers in the bargaining unit. So it did a bunch of things. Some of the older provisions are gone. There was an anti-communist provision that basically said that anybody who was a member of the Communist Party or another, or similar could not be a labor leader in the U.S. And that was used as a basis to expel left-led unions from the Congress of Industrial Organizations. But anyway, the injunction powers were very significant because what it allowed was for the president in a strike that he or, she maybe in the future, if they deemed the strike to be of really significant national importance, something that would really damage the economy, things involving interstate trade, and of course global trade as well, then the president, they get to appoint a committee, go over the facts, and then seek a court-ordered injunction. And historically, as you know, in the longshore industry, those injunctions were easy to come by. So 1971, the West Coast longshoremen and the ILWU went on a strike. The strike was going on for a few months, and then President Nixon sought the injunction, got it, 80-day cooling off period. The strike resumed, but Congress was about to take further action to force an agreement before the two sides actually tentatively agreed to a contract. Carter did not seek an injunction in 1977 in the last ILA strike, but President George W. Bush did in the 2002 lockout involving the ILWU.
So, Professor, you mentioned that you think it's pretty unlikely, against the backdrop of what's happening right now, you think it's pretty unlikely that the Taft-Hartley Act is going to get invoked before January 15, which is deadline for the suspension. So, I mean, as Rich alluded to earlier, we've got a lot going on politically here. We also, we're watching closely, Hurricane Milton yesterday. We've got, there's concerns about emergency supplies, et cetera, being able to be distributed through ports. So why do you think it's unlikely that this is ultimately going to end up being invoked, at least this time?
Yeah, I mean, both parties agreed, and a lot of this had to do with the White House and Julie Hsu, our labor secretary, working to get the wage agreement tentatively agreed on. That was a major sticking point. But the union and the U.S. Maritime Alliance have agreed to work under the provisions of the now expired contract. So there really is no risk of a Taft-Hartley injunction happening as the industry is working. And come January 15th, that's significant. I don't think the strike will resume. Of course, that would coincide with a new presidential administration happening. If it's a Harris administration, and unlikely event of the strike resuming, she would face the similar, same kind of principles President Biden has. And there's never been a Democratic president who has successfully invoked a Taft-Hartley injunction. And in all these cases, they haven't sought them. Carter sought one for a coal strike, but the court refused to actually issue it at the time. So Harris, I don't think, would intervene. Trump, that perhaps he would. But like I said, I think they'll reach an agreement by January 15th in order for the ILA to agree to suspend the strike. Usually, especially when a union is in a strong position, as they clearly are, that shows they're very close. Plus, the Maritime Alliance is not seeking to amend existing contract language around the new technology committee and other agreements around automation. So, for instance, there was already an agreement that new automation wouldn't be fully automated in that with the absence of workers. So I think they're going to be close. Perhaps we'll see clarification of that language, strengthening of certain positions. But I think there's going to be a new agreement.
Professor William Brewster, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, millions of people have been sucked into the latest Netflix series on the famed Menendez murder case. Some may be on this panel, actually. Robert Rand is an Emmy and DuPont award-winning journalist. He's an author. He's been covering the case of the Menendez brothers for the last 35 years, including for the Miami Herald. He's probably got some thoughts on how realistic this series really is. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, Robert, as Ryan mentioned, you've been covering the Menendez brothers case since the day after their parents were killed back in August of 1989. The brothers are currently serving life sentences without parole after being convicted of first-degree murder. In addition to covering the trials, you've also written various pieces for numerous publications as well as a book, and you've served as a consultant and executive producer for various documentaries on the brothers. What is it about this case that made you decide to spend so much of your journalistic career covering it? And why do you think that this case, which is 35 plus years old at this point, why do you think it garners so much attention even today?
Well, it's Beverly Hills, kids killing their parents, a Hollywood executive who made $2 million a year. The brothers were nationally ranked tennis players. There were 7 months between the crime in 1989 and the arrest of the brothers in March of 1990. And the story did not become an international sensation until the brothers were arrested. So I think that people just followed the case closely, like a soap opera or novella, because the first trial was covered live, gavel to gavel, including the evidence series on Court TV. And so people not only in the States, but all over the world could watch everything that happened.
Sir, what do you make of the Netflix documentary? Of course, it's gotten a lot of attention, lots of views. And one of the more controversial allegations made is that the brothers were involved in a sexual relationship. What's your take on all of that?
Well, first, I want to say that most viewers, unfortunately, don't realize the difference between a scripted, fictionalized TV series, very loosely based on facts, and a documentary. Documentaries are traditionally just facts. A scripted TV series can take any interpretation, and that's what Ryan Murphy has done in Monsters. And the theory that he proposes, that Erica Lyle Menendez had a incestuous sexual relationship as adults, is completely false. It never happened. I'm sorry. I know that he has defended that, And he has said that he is relying on the reporting or rumors or whatever of Dominic Dunn, who used to be a very popular writer for Vanity Fair. But it's simply not true. And it's just a one example of a number of scenes that are false in that series.
How do the brothers feel about this depiction?
Well, Eric and Lon Menendez do not have the internet in state prison in California, so they haven't actually seen the series. However, they've certainly heard about it from their wives and their family, and they're very unhappy because the two guys that I met back in October of 1989, when I spent 3 days with them interviewing them for the Miami Herald, they were 18 and 21 years old. They were conservative, soft-spoken, somewhat shy, and they were nothing like the characters the actors portray in Monsters.
So, Robert, in addition to this Netflix series bringing the Menendez brothers back into the news, there's also a reconsideration of their case that's currently underway with a review of evidence that you assisted and helped bring to light regarding the sexual abuse that they had suffered, and asking for a review of that evidence to see if it has any relevance and pertinence to the prior convictions. Can you tell us a little bit more about this evidence and where the review of their convictions currently stands?
Sure. So in May of 2023, I was the co-EP and co-creator of a documentary on Peacock called Menendez Plus Menudo, Boys Betrayed. And we revealed new evidence in that documentary where our primary character was a gentleman by the name of Roy Rosello, a former member of the band Latin boy band Menudo, who is now in his early 50s. And he came forward for the first time and said that he had been raped by Jose Menendez when he was 14 years old. And in the documentary, he only told us about one incident. We've now since learned that there are multiple incidents that took place over a period of several years. And we are hoping to produce new episodes of the documentary. The other major piece of new evidence is a letter that Eric Menendez wrote to his cousin Andy Cano in late 1988, 9 months before the killing of Jose and Kitty Menendez. And in that letter, Eric Menendez complains about the ongoing sexual abuse by his father, Jose. And he also writes about his mother being, you know, totally out of it, and that he wished he could talk to her, but she's so out of it, she can't. And she knows that she will just take Jose's side. So those two new pieces of evidence have become the foundation for a habeas petition that was filed 24 hours after our documentary was released. And for 16 months, the LA County DA has had that habeas petition on their desk, and they keep asking for 90-day extensions to review the case. And I was as surprised as the rest of the world when a few days ago, LA County DA George Gascon called a news conference and said, you know, that he's seriously reviewing the new evidence. The reality is that DA Gascon could have held the exact same news conference 6 months ago or a year ago. And it's just coincidental that he happens to be running for re-election in a very tight race. And he got all the cameras and media people to turn out for his news coverage.
Well, it sounds like we can get the truth in your book. What's the name of the book? Where can we find it?
Okay, the book is called The Menendez Murders, but you want to be sure and order the updated edition, which has a red cover, because for some strange reason, my publisher is still selling the original book, which came out in 2018. So order the book with the red cover that says updated edition on the cover.
Journalist and author Robert Rand, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois super lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We have the pleasure of being joined once again by Pat Millhiser. He's a writer, storyteller, problem solver, relationship builder for Millhiser Public Relations, based here in Chicago. You may have seen him before on WTTW. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we have in this corner Lisa Stiegel, Director of Marketing of Downey & Lenkoff, called in from reserve off the bench, but she's ready to go. Let's get her going. Welcome, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, or forcing me, I should say.
25 days until the election. You wouldn't think Donald Trump's legal issues would get used against him on the campaign trail, would they? Of course they would. Rich, everything's fair in love and politics, isn't
We also got a reference that Pat is the former editor-in-chief of the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin, the Bible for all things legal here in Chicago. So he's no stranger to covering these legal stories, especially when we throw a couple of brand new ones at him seconds before the broadcast begins. So, Pat, we appreciate your perspective. Yeah, I mean, we do this Trump watch every episode. We have for many years. Hopefully, I have a strong feeling that Trump watch will continue in the future, even if Trump loses. We know there'll be legal challenges. But, you know, obviously the big news last week between our last episode and today is Tina Jack Smith, who is leading the January 6th charges against Trump, came out with some new allegations, or I should say some of his existing allegations were revealed. Now, there's some dispute as to whether this was a motion by Jack Smith. If you believe that, you know, Trump supporters, it was Jack Smith engaged in election interference. That's why he released it now, a few weeks before the election, or that the judge released it. In any case, there were some pretty interesting revelations contained in there, much worse, in my opinion, than we knew before. A lot of examples of what Trump was doing, according to Jack Smith, and trying to keep power that day. More evidence of him sitting in the dining room, and when confronted with what was going on, allegedly, according to the complaints, that I don't care. But the real question is, Tina, will this have any impact on the electorate? Is anyone looking at the Jack Smith news and thinking, oh, wow, I thought Trump was, you know, going to be a great president and was great before, and now I'm going to vote for Kamala because of this? Does any of this really move the needle?
I agree with you. That's the critical question. And I think that the public is getting increasingly desensitized to all of this because there's been so much of this in the media, and there doesn't seem to be any meaningful moving of the needle in either direction, and which is good for Trump. What I found interesting was how Kamala Harris used some of this as fodder for some of her most recent ads, which, you know, I think that she's been trying to stay above board, if you will, with respect to the ads. But given that we're in the final weeks of the election, I think the gloves are coming off and people are using, I mean, she's going to use what she's got at this point. So, but to answer your question, Rich, I don't think this meaningfully will move the needle.
Pat, public relations, right? How do you think both sides of this campaign have used this news in advancing their agendas right before the election?
I think it's a very effective ad that the Harris campaign put out, but I don't think the electorate is moving on this issue at this point. I think January 6th was either disqualifying for you on January 6th, 2021, or it wasn't. And I think people are not focused on that. I think you've made up your mind there and you're looking at other other issues that they're talking about, whether it's the economy, whether it's foreign affairs. But I think people's minds are made up, and you've decided whether or not that act that day was disqualifying or not, or you have ways that you can rationalize to yourself that it's not a big factor in the election.
Lisa, this news impactful at all in Indiana among your circles?
No, I think people's already made up their mind. It's just, it is what it is. Everybody's already know who they're going to vote for at this point.
Big question is whether those undecideds are actually going to be voters or not, whether they're deciding to actually vote. Well, moving along, I moved some merch this week. I sold a Mark Jackson 1990 basketball card on eBay. It went for $17.50. So Chipotle lunch is in my future. But who cares about a 34-year-old basketball card of a one-time All-Star? Nobody cares about Mark Jackson. They care about the two brothers in the front seat or in the front row. Tina, any idea who those two brothers would be on this Mark Jackson card?
Talking about the Menendez brothers?
Yes, they are front row center. And this is one of the hottest cards you can find on eBay right now because they are sitting there watching the game. And I figured might as well strike while the iron's hot. So why is the iron hot right now?
So as we talked with one of our guests earlier in the show, Ryan, the Menendez brothers are actually getting a lot of airplay right now for a couple of reasons. First, there's the recent Netflix series where it's the Ryan Murphy Monster series, which, as we discussed, has been criticized for its innuendo that the brothers were not just brothers, but that they also had an incestuous relationship, and spoke with our guest earlier in the show about why he doesn't think there's any merit to this. And as we also touched on, the brothers are making news with the review that is currently underway of the habeas corpus petition that they filed in May of last year, which includes new evidence regarding the sexual abuse that they say they endured, and asking for a review of that evidence. As our listeners may recall, their father had been sexually abusing them. They claimed that their mother was an alcoholic and also allowed the abuse to continue and was also abusive. And they claimed that they really shot their parents in self-defense. The judge in the second trial had limited the testimony on the point of the sexual abuse claim, which is really the pivotal issue here in the habeas corpus petition that they filed. So the LADA is currently reviewing the evidence and said that he will issue or provide a non-binding formal opinion by the end of November. So, Rich, there are several ways that this can possibly go. It looks like the brothers could either get a new trial, they may be resentenced, or they could actually just walk out of jail and be freed. What's interesting is that Kim Kardashian, of all people, who we love here on Legal Face Off, has actually come to the brothers' defense and said that she thinks that they've rehabilitated themselves, and that that should be a sufficient grounds for purposes of them either getting a shortened sentence or walking out of jail.
Sick of these guys. Enough already. The only two brothers I'm more sick of are the Kelseys. Enough of the Kelseys, especially the, not Travis, but the other one. Sick Jason. Of that guy, Jason. Enough of that guy. Get off my screen, Kelsey brothers, forever. Enough of the Menendez brothers. The series I found unwatchable. But also, from a legal perspective, like, remember, these guys got already two bites of the apple. The first trial was a mistrial because the jury was deadlocked on the abuse excuse. The concept that, despite the fact that they didn't go to get any help and they planned this shooting, not in the middle of some confrontation with their parents, but the parents were on the couch. They were watching TV in their den when these two brothers got shotguns, as is depicted in the series, and shot them dead. So the first trial was deadlocked. The second trial, they were found guilty because the abuse allegations were not allowed to be heard by the jury. So, you know, opening this case up again, giving them a third bite, I understand the culture is different. I think quite appropriately so. We understand these allegations of sexual abuse more than we did then. But you would have to overcome that presumption that that abuse would get in front of the jury anyway. So let's remember that this DA is in the middle of a re-election campaign, and he's, in my opinion, using this as part of that. But Lisa, are you watching the series, either the Netflix series or the new documentary? What are your thoughts?
I haven't watched anything new. I watched the old stuff, like on Dateline when it did come out, and it's hard to explain. I mean, how do you know if they were sexually abused or not? I guess that's what the lying factor is here.
Yeah. And Pat, what do you think? Should they get another shot?
Well, I think you're right. Obviously, our understanding of abuse has changed. Also, our understanding of brain science has changed. Certain court programs do recognize the science that says people are not fully functioning adults until they're 26 years old. But I think that's balanced against exactly what you brought up, Rich, is the fact that this involves a murder and a planned one. And that to me is just going to be a very difficult hurdle to get over when you are putting it in front of a judge or a jury.
Robert just joined us.
Yeah, Robert joined us. Should we keep it going?
Got an even bigger group than ever. Let's go.
Hey, sorry, guys.
Hi, Robert.
Sorry, I was interviewing an employee that ran way over and I then lost track of time. So my apologies.
Well, let's do this then. We also have Robert Johnson of Solomon Group, LLC. He's got 25 years of global legal business franchise and crisis managed experience, and was previously the franchise relations officer for McDonald's Central Division, and was also featured in the book Discover Your Inner Strength. So, Mr. Johnson, thanks for joining us in the middle of the grab bag. We're gonna throw you right into it. Does that work?
That works.
Let's do it. Let's stick with LA. There's been a guilty plea in Matthew Perry's ketamine overdose death. Tina, what's the latest in this case?
So, Ryan, it's hard to believe it's been nearly a year since Friend star Matt Perry drowned in his hot tub after a ketamine overdose. And as we reported here back in August, five people have been charged in connection with his death, including his personal assistant who administered the last dose of ketamine before he died. Mark Chavez is one of the doctors who is in those five who were charged, and he is one of the doctors accused of giving the ketamine to Perry. And last week, he pled guilty to one count of conspiring to distribute ketamine. He said in his plea agreement that he and a second doctor, who is also one of the five charged, Salvador Plasencia, began supplying ketamine to Perry shortly before his death. Plasencia apparently called Chavez to get the ketamine. Chavez had it on hand after filling a fraudulent prescription. And Chavez claims that Plasencia was injecting Perry with the drug and leaving vials with Perry and his assistant so that they could administer it themselves. Rich, there's a whole lot wrong with what Chavez was doing here, including selling the ketamine outside of this, what is deemed the scope of medical practice for an illegitimate purpose, as well as administering it and selling it so that it can be administered by Perry as well as his assistant, and just making money off of somebody who was a known addict. He also lied on a bunch of forms to secure the ketamine in his first place. He lied about who his employer was, and he actually took some of the ketamine with him when he left the business that he had with his partner last year. Chavez is currently out on bond and has waived his right to be indicted by a grand jury, and he's facing a maximum of 10 years in prison and will be sentenced in April. So, Rich, I think we're just going to keep hearing more about this. Clearly, this doctor has been telling, you know, the authorities what's been going on, what happened here. And I think that this is going to become a pretty big web of people who are involved. We know that the ketamine queen has been implicated in this as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the story before, and of course, you know, what this doctor did, not just in supplying these drugs, but, you know, we read about these text messages where he and his other indicted conspirators agree to basically rip off Matthew Perry. It's not bad enough that they supply these drugs that killed him, but, you know, they were ripping him off, basically. So, yeah, throw the book at this guy. I mean, Robert, I don't know. There's much other take that one could have, but hopefully, in my opinion, he gets this 10-year max.
Yeah, the only other thing I would add is that it feels like we've seen an unfortunate string of doctors doing acting in this manner I think back to, the incident involving Michael Jackson. You know, we have this incident, and it's just extremely unfortunate that, these things continue to happen. And I'm hopeful that, to your point, if the book is thrown at this individual, that it will have a chilling effect for future, as it relates to future behavior of doctors behaving badly, so to speak.
Yeah, Pat, you've probably covered some of these stories in the past. I'm sure you covered the Michael Jackson and other stories. Throw the book at these guys.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to basically who's accountable here, and someone will be held accountable. And of course, it's tough because this is just overall a sad story of addiction and greed and, taking advantage of somebody. So, I think that's going to end up being the result. And you do hope that there is some sort of a deterrent effect to prevent us from hearing more stories like this. But also at the end of the day, I think what does get lost is this is, just another example of addiction that affects anybody. Just raising the public awareness of that. And what can we do more to guide people toward treatment? I know that happened several times here for Perry, but that always has to be part of the discussion.
Yeah, and with that, I mean, I just feel for the family because, I mean, these things are not just, obviously there's a death here that took place, but, the survivors have a whole lot of healing and a whole lot of grief to deal with. And that story very seldom gets told. It's unfortunate, but that's the other side that we have to look at as well.
Right. We always looked at addiction as ruining the lives of the people and the person around it. And now what this kind of represents is an extension to it. It ruins the lives of people who try to find an opportunity and are accused of taking advantage of an opportunity in an addiction. And that's something new.
Speaking of taking advantage of an opportunity, we've got a crazy story out of South Korea. A court has ruled that a South Korean man cannot be charged with drunk driving because he chugged an entire bottle of liquor between the time that he was pulled over and the time that he took his breathalyzer. So there's no way to verify that he was drunk while he was behind the wheel. Rich, fill us in on this.
The intrepid legal face-off media team knows no boundaries. We go where the stories take us, even to Daegu, South Korea, Ryan, as you know. I think you had this assignment. Didn't you go on behalf of Legal Faceoff? Didn't we send you to South Korea to cover this one? Maybe. Remarkably, he beat the system by just chugging. People have been trying to get out of crimes forever, and we've covered a lot of these, and particularly DUIs. People think that, let me not take the test, let me not submit my blood. This guy figured I'll just chug more. Let me drink more. He drank an entire bottle of soju, which is rice wine, about 12.5% alcohol content, in 39 seconds. I mean, I'd be more concerned that I would die from doing that than getting arrested. But yeah, the court said that because they couldn't tell how drunk he was before, case dismissed. So, Tina, we don't advise any of this, certainly not to Robert, who's pulled over, thankfully. But, this guy in South Korea figured it out.
Yeah, we don't want any.
It's a brilliant legal strategy.
Yeah, we don't want any kids trying this at home or in cars or anything either. It is a brilliant legal strategy. And my guess is that no one in the U.S. was smart enough to come up with such a legal strategy. So, kudos to this individual. Query whether he's going to end up getting the book thrown at him for something else. Good way to outsmart the authorities.
Lisa, have you ever drank any amount of soju, let alone an entire bottle, in less than a minute?
No, I don't think I've drank anything in less than a minute besides a shot. But it's going to be a trending new DUI defense in the U.S. if this cuts out,
Yeah.
I wonder what it did for soju liquor sales in China.
Beat the system. Try it. Well, we've used the word outsmart and brilliant for a man who was essentially drunk. So, it's
good message for the kids.
It's just how we roll. All right. A former sound engineer who wrote a book about his days working on the Fleetwood Mac album Rumours is suing the makers of the Broadway hit Stereophonic. Tina, does he have a case or is he telling lies, telling sweet little lies?
Oh, funny, Ryan. Wow. So in my humble opinion, I think Ken Collet, who we're talking about, actually may have a case here. So he has filed suit against the Broadway play Stereophonic, claiming that the playwright took his 2012 memoir about working on Rumours with the band Fleetwood Mac, committed copyright infringement. He claims that he lifted portions of the book without permission when making the play. So what's interesting here, and we've covered some of these other types of cases on Legal Face-Off, is the play doesn't mention the band members by name, nor does it mention the songs by name. But what's interesting is that there are some strong parallels between the people who are characters in the play and the members of Fleetwood Mac. And if you take a look at the complaint, which I did, there's some interesting counts to the complaint where they go through pretty significant detail comparing some incidents that happened with the band while they were recording it, the album, comparing it to similar situational aspects of the play. What I think stands out the most, Rich, is that there's a scene of the play that sounds strangely familiar when you look at the book where Lindsey Buckingham is recording a guitar solo. He doesn't like it. He tells Ken Collet to record over it. Ken Collet does that. He re-records the solo. And then Lindsey Buckingham says, well, I think I preferred the other one better, and proceeds to try to strangle Collet when he tells him, sorry, Lindsey, I recorded over that last take. So what's interesting is there's a very similar situational aspect to the play that is conveyed. And so when you take all of these things together, it does actually, in my opinion, tip it potentially to the copyright infringement side. Just having an idea of a band that's going through a lot of turmoil is not protectable. But when you express the circumstances in a way that is very similar or the same to what has been done before in a copyrighted work, that's copyright infringement. So as you know, Rich, I'm an IP lawyer, so I love these kinds of stories, especially about one of my all-time favorite bands, Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, I love the Mac. I mean, if I was defending this case, I guess I would say don't stop pursuing this case because you're gonna win only in your dreams. You're gonna lose this case in a landslide. You should go your own way, pursue some other case because you're over your head. How'd we do? Anyone count how many?
Well done. That was like six.
Well done. Yeah.
That was relatively on the fly. But we cover lots of these stories, Robert, about it seems like every time there's some success that someone else is coming out of the woodwork and alleging that there's some license or infringement. But are you a Fleetwood Mac fan?
I am, but I don't think I could do a riff to compare to what you just did off the fly. So that was very impressive.
All right. Last two topics here in the grab bag have to do with lawyering. Rich, first story, law firms are failing at the single most basic lawyer task. What's that?
Can't make this stuff up. Yeah, communication. I mean, the Clio 2024 Legal Trends Report says that this was a secret shopper type of survey, Tina. Contacting 1,000 firms by email, another 500 by phone to gauge how they handle potential new clients. The results weren't great. 67% of firms didn't respond to emails, which is actually worse than the last time they looked at this, which was 2019. 48% of firms either didn't answer the phone or failed to call back, which is, again, about 20% worse than 2019. And then the survey also showed that when these firms did respond, the quality of the responses weren't great. So listen, we talk a lot on this show over 10 years about the quality of some of the work we're seeing out there. Sometimes we bemoan the next generation of customer service people in our industry who don't quite get it. Thankfully, we work with lots of great people who do get it. But, you know, this communication is so central to what we do. And something we talk to young people about. And, you know, I think a lot of lawyers don't understand that first and foremost, we're in the customer service business. So I think the survey sort of plays that out.
I thought the survey was interesting. You know, as a young lawyer, you know, we all learn that you return a client's call. And if you have a potential lead on new business, you should definitely return the call too. But I think the counterbalance to that is something that I see, especially in big law, where we have to be concerned about, first of all, sometimes these outreaches are not genuine. And they will say things like, you know, please refer to the attached zip file for a complaint that's been filed against us, when actually it's got some sort of a, you know, malware on it. I've seen that. I've also seen attempts to conflict a firm out of particular work by doing this kind of outreach. So I completely agree, Rich, that calls should be answered, especially with existing clients and when it's a when it looks like a legitimate lead to new business. But there's also a bad side to it where people abuse it and try to use people's zeal for getting business against them in some of the situations that I just mentioned.
So I got to tell a little story here with my friend Robert, who we go way back with. And as Ryan mentioned, Robert used to be with McDonald's, and whatever the title was, he was the man. Whatever the title, the formal title was, Robert Johnson was the man. And we would have these yearly meetings at Hamburger U, back when it used to be in beautiful Oakbrook rather than in the West Loop, which it is now. Hamburger U, for those of you that don't know, is the headquarters for McDonald's. And Robert would summon all of his lawyers, of which I was, to a beautiful meeting for a day or 2 days in Oakbrook, Illinois. And he would tell us what's what, the state of the panel, the state of litigation for McDonald's. And he ran it incredibly well. But he would come in that first day, always looking as dapper as he does today, always with some swag, always wearing that mantle of the man. And I'll never forget that at one of these meetings early on, he said the following words, and they rang true and they stayed in my brain. He goes, "When I call you, you better call me right back. When you call me, I'll call you back when I want." And that was true back then, but it spoke to what we're talking about today, which is serve your client, call them back, and don't just call them back, but provide good, strong legal analysis when you do. Robert, is that all still true today as it was back in maybe the early 2000s when we first met?
Well, I certainly am not the man. Not sure that I ever was, but I'll take it. But the mantra, I think, still rings true. You know, people call lawyers because they have a problem. It is very seldom that people call us to chit chat. So if they call you, it's usually because they are in need of a solution. And what I would always tell, particularly lawyers, when you're working with in-house lawyers, is that we operate at the speed of business, not at the speed of law. So the reason that I'm calling you is because my client is calling me about it. So I'm calling you. So I need an answer. So a lackadaisical response typically doesn't suffice. And it's unfortunate because, you know, as lawyers, we're in the business of providing legal services. And that business part of it is it involves customer service. And then if you want to become that trusted advisor, which every lawyer's goal is to become that trusted advisor, the way you earn trust is to be responsive and to be proactive. Unless you are on the clock, you'll never be, unless you bill for overcommunication, you'll never get charged for overcommunication.
It's a great, great answer. Well stated. Pat, you've been around lawyers for a large part of your career. Has the quality of legal communication devolved over the years?
I mean, what I've always gotten from lawyers is if there's service to provide and value to add, they're going to get involved. And we're talking about this is incoming new business, right? Not existing clients. I think people are choosy on what they get involved in, how much time at the moment that they have to take on another problem that may or may not be able to be resolved. You know, I think in a lot of cases, lawyers do get calls for problems that don't necessarily have a legal solution. And, you know, time is money, literally. and you have clients to serve. So this isn't too surprising to me. I think it's a different story when we are talking about existing clients. If you're ghosting existing clients, that's a problem. Incoming business, I think that's just becoming a fact of life.
All right. And finally, in the grab bag, a new survey from the ABA Journal shows lawyers are happy people, satisfied with their pay and their career. This was one that Rich threw in there, but I got to ask Lisa, is this pretty spot on?
It is spot on. I would agree.
Rich, yeah. What do you think?
I mean, business is booming, really, in the legal world. I mean, deals are up, compensation's way up. You know, I think we covered last show. I'm almost positive we did that. The new ceiling has just been broken. It used to be $1,000 an hour was the big news, and then $2,000 an hour. Finally, now some lawyers are charging $3,000 an hour. So, you know, you're damn right. Over half of lawyers are satisfied because they're getting paid a ton. And as we know, as we've covered, you know, it starts in big law firms like the one that Tina works at, that, you know, you can't keep talent unless you're competitive with salary. So once one raises their incoming salaries and bonuses, all of the other firms follow suit. So according to the survey, Tina, most people are happy with their salaries. I think it's also pertinent, as we've covered before, that salaries aren't the only thing, although they're very important, but that compensation isn't the only thing that people are finding important. You know, we've covered many times on the show that work-life balance and life outside the firm is important. So I think the takeaway here is that lawyers are doing pretty well given the current market.
Rich, and I'd say to your point about, you know, mental health and well-being and work-life balance, I do think that I see it more than ever that there's conversations around it, particularly with firm management, because we hear about it more and more from the generations that we're hiring from, that they would rather have the work life balance that they want versus the compensation. So I think it's just about striking that right balance. And I think that it evolves over time. And obviously it's really dependent on market conditions too. And which areas are hot and which areas are not and all these other things. But I'm seeing this whole notion of mental health and well-being, which I think is something that does need to be prioritized. I'm glad to see that it's getting a lot more airplay and attention, because that will often override other things like compensation, as it should.
Guys, we'll wrap up with a roundtable here question. We talked about Fleetwood Mac, right? They are responsible for one of the most popular and best-selling albums. Album used to be a thing. I've got one on my wall here. It used to be a back now. But albums of all time, Rumors. Let's go around and learn everyone's favorite record album of all time. It can't be Rumors. Pick another one. Let's start with Pat. Pat, favorite record of all time?
Man. I mean, the band that I grew up with that I still see today is Pearl Jam. Mm. I travel around the country for them. It's hard for me to pick a favorite. I will say their newest one and their newest tour, Dark Matter, is a very, very good album, and they're moving into the visual space where if you go to a show now, they have a whole video screen show behind them that's new, and they're probably getting ready for their Vegas Sphere residency. But I'll give you Vitalogy, because that reminds me of driving around in my 87 old Cutlass in the mid-90s in the heyday of grunge. That one puts me back in the mid-90s, so I'll say that.
Wow. We veered off into Millhiser's album corner for a second there. Ryan Burrow, favorite album of all time.
I approve of Vitalogy, by the way. That was a good choice. I'm going to go with Beastie Boys' Hello Nasty at Intergalactic and stuff like that. I just remember that was my last year before going to college, and I just played the heck out of that CD on my Walkman. So I'll go with that. I just listened to it a couple of weeks ago for the first time in years, and I'm like, still love it. So
good one. Yeah. Good one. By the way, as Pat was talking about the struggle for the best Pearl Jam album, I encourage our listeners to check out the temporarily on hold podcast called Trial by Vinyl, hosted by me and a former WGN employee, where we discussed this very debate about which album of major artists is the best. And we covered Pearl Jam. So you got to check out Trial by Vinyl. wherever you get your podcasts. Robert Johnson, favorite album of all time?
Favorite album of all times is Kinda Blue by Miles Davis. And a special shout out to Maxwell, going to see him tonight. So he's up there too.
Wow, Maxwell. It's a good shout out. Lisa, what's your favorite album of all time?
I have to go AC/DC Back in Black.
That's a great one. The first album with the new singer of AC/DC after the last one.
Paris. I got that one at the Columbia House record, or the CD club.
Oh, they're still coming after me. They're still they're still trying to collect from various aliases that I used in 1982 through 84.
Nice.
That's a good one. Tina, favorite album of all time?
Oh, so hard. I've got so many albums. It's crazy, but I'm going to have to go with the Beatles Abbey Road.
Wow.
Love that album.
Swing for the Fences. My favorite is, it's gotta be The River or Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen. Great albums. One last shout out for Fleetwood Mac. If you're a Fleetwood Mac fan, the world's greatest Fleetwood Mac cover band is playing tonight, right tonight in Chicago. Band called Secondhand News. Huge fan of the band. They're playing right by the river at Tiny Tap. So we encourage everyone to go check them out. They do an uncanny representation of the great Fleetwood Mac.
Rich, what do you wear to something like that, Rich?
I dress like Stevie Nicks circa 1974. I've got lots of flowing robes, scarves. I dress like a gypsy. But you'll have to get the answer to that when you join me tonight right by the river. Everyone's invited. Let's go.
Fantastic. Well, we better wrap this up then. Thank you so much, Lisa Stiegel, Robert Johnson, and Pat Millhiser. And that'll do it for the latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. Special thanks to Rutgers professor William Brusher, journalist and author Robert Rand, University of Chicago professor and author Allison LaCroix, and shout out to Ben Anderson as well. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...